years ago, I remember Barbara Tuchman writing a book called The March of Folly about how military people, political leaders, just persist in wrong analysis, wrong diagnosis, wrong prescription, and just keep going until finally, usually, they lose or the public says, get them out of there. So the capacity to deny reality, it's just so common in war by political leaders and by generals. If you study something like the First World War, you pretty much see that these people, the generals, the leaders, were acting in the dark. They had no idea what they were doing. And they were throwing hundreds of thousands of lives around as if they were popcorn. And it's this carelessness about lives, this lack of thinking things through, that it just continually shocks me. So I don't have a good explanation for it other than that it's just a doleful pattern throughout history.
I remember when I first heard that Don Rumsfeld had said the war will last 6 weeks, probably not 6 months. I thought of the sleeping plan.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. That was supposed to wrap it up by, M31, September 31, it was going to be all wrapped up. I mean, to believe in that stuff, and to think that whole nations can gamble on that. Of course, the fact is whole nations didn't. This is about leaders. The Kaiser, Bush, they had nations in the palms of their hand, even democracies. You got to have leaders who have character and who have judgment. Anyone looking at George Bush's biography would have seen a record of upward failure. His father bailing him out at each step. And would have said, here's a guy with a propensity to fail big time who has the, on the other side, has the feeling that his dad is going to rescue him. What a dangerous combination. And yet that kind of talk about candidates never gets into the public print. I don't think I heard anyone say that about Bush. And it's not psychoanalysis, it's just realistic psychology. It's like, you know, well, what's his biography? That doesn't mean what are the facts of his biography. What's the pattern here? We're in the hands of leaders. The people would never have gone for the Schlieffen Plan. And if they weren't half scared to death, and if they knew that there were no weapons of mass destruction there, especially nuclear weapons, voters wouldn't have gone for the Iraq War.
And that's, that gets the point of why we're talking today. Why did so many of the pundits, of the journalists, of the people who should have been asking these important questions not ask them? I mean, what's wrong with the American media that these questions don't get asked?
Well, for one thing, just as we've been talking, using our shorthand, talking about history, especially military history, they don't know anything. They don't know anything. They've never read history. They've never really engaged with it. They don't, the history of warfare especially. Or if they have, it's been, you know, as daring do and, you know, patriotic, which is fine, but so there's ignorance. Anything that happened yesterday doesn't exist for an American journalist, I don't think. There are exceptions. But how rare is it in reading a columnist or a pundit that you see references to history? You don't. So I think that's a big reason right there. I think the second reason, especially for people like Friedman, who I think is egregious, someone like that, it's respectable to be for war. It's always respectable. Because that's what the realistic hard guys think, you know. You can think, well, gee, our power, we can create new ways of life there. Look what we did in Germany and Japan. You know, they want to be taken seriously. They want to be in the conversation. And I think that desire for, you know, relevance and the power people will read you. You won't be marginalized. Boy, I think for these columnists, they want to be quoted. They want to be cited by the people who matter. So they have to believe in the people who matter. And how often was Tom Friedman cited? Cited by people who said, well, even Tom Friedman. Boy, when you're quoted that way, That's Valhalla for the columnist.
Right.
Even Tom Friedman.
You've just proved your even-handedness.
Yes, exactly. Right. Exactly.
In that February 5th column of yours, you point out that this is what Michael O'Hanlon of the Brookings Institute says. This is what William Nordhaus, who's a Yale economist, says it's going to cost. And there was no one doing that. There was no one bringing all these different sources together. No one was looking for this evidence. You were gathering information that was already publicly available, bringing it together into a cohesive argument, and making your argument. And yet, the Thomas Friedmans, who were basically crossing their fingers and saying, oh, this is what's going to happen, this is going to sprout freedom, they're on TV still today.
Yeah, well, of course, they couldn't cite any evidence. There was none. They were just giving you their logic. Well, that's fine. But what do we know? What do experts think? What has the past shown? Those are questions that just get in the way of being a big thinker. You don't want to get weighed down by any evidence.
On May 1st, the day that Bush was strutting across the flight deck of Abraham Lincoln, your article was published that talked about Isaiah Berlin's idea of the bent twig.
Well, I mean, nationalism, I mean, it's what defeated us in Vietnam, right? That wasn't about communism. That was about trying to turn back a nationalist revolution. You don't do it. People don't give up. It's the most powerful force in the 20th century. And you invent it sometimes by invading people. That's what happened when Napoleon invaded Germany, created German nationalism. And people will fight for their country against even benign occupations. They don't want to be occupied. They'd rather have the devil they know. Everything in history argues that when you try to subdue a people or change their, or occupy them, this is what happens. They respond. There's an insurgency. There are attacks. And then they begin to divide. And then, you know, you get civil war. I mean, the Israelis found that out, both this time when they went into Lebanon, but I'm thinking also of 20 years ago, and then they stayed in Lebanon for 20 years and finally had to leave because they couldn't, you know, they couldn't sustain the losses that Hezbollah was inflicting on them. I think there simply is no utility to military force once you take out the position of armies on the field. I think military force can deter invasion and you know, things like one state invading another, a la the Gulf War. I think it's completely counterproductive in any war against peoples or in any occupation. Once you turn to occupation, you've had it.
Do you believe that there is any possibility of turning this around now? I'm kind of the mind that we might have had a chance at one point, but we've kind of lost that thread.
I don't think there was any time when this was going to produce any result that we would be satisfied with. I think that the elections, what we think of as the cure, made everything worse. I mean, it brought a Shiite government to power. That's against our long-term interest with Iran right there. And, of course, it revealed the fissures, the religious fissures in the society. And it made the Sunnis think they were going to be isolated, as they are. And that brought on the Civil War. So what we thought was the cure was actually the worst thing that could have happened. They would have been better off with a military junta governing them for a while and trying to get basic services up and going. And the idea of elections in that context and the idea that that's what democracy is, rather than the rule of law, rotation of parties, freedom of the press. Sunnis were on the top for hundreds of years, and suddenly they're going to be subordinated. They're not going to accept that, even though it's democratic. It never was in the cards that any good result could come out of this. And even getting rid of the dictator, I think they were all better off with him. At least you knew, you know, where the boundaries were. There was some rationality to life. It wasn't this Hobbesian slaughter.
Well, there were the George Packers and the Kenneth McKeas and the people that really wouldn't normally be behind a power play war, who supported it for human rights reasons. And yet, when you look at the evidence available, it's still, like you said, it wasn't going to turn out correct.
It wasn't going to turn out any way you looked at it, if you just thought a moment about historical precedent.
Who else got it right? Who else in the media would you point to who got it particularly correct?
I think Paul Krugman, from early on, got it right. And I think that there were bloggers then.
Right. But we're just dirty hippies, so.
Oh, right, right. But, I mean, there was... Well, there was one blanking on the name of the blog. Anyway, this guy, he was fabulous. I mean, he got evidence. I mean, when Powell made his speech at the UN, I went on the air, and using stuff I got off his website and others, I said, well, Powell made this claim about this site, but here's what the inspector said, and here's what journalists have said, and, you know, quoting. And he said that about, you know, these planes, these drones, but here's what experts say. When Powell made his speech, people said, oh, that case closed. Case closed. And the bloggers were getting it right. You know, they were saying, this doesn't make any sense. And yet the so-called serious journalism wasn't. And that made me a devotee of the blogs, much to the loss of my time. I think that really showed that there's a reason newspapers are dying. There's a reason no one's watching the evening news. There's a reason only 600,000 people watch CNN at best. And the reason is that journalism isn't very good. The journalists aren't very smart. And they don't really know anything. And they don't challenge power. So if you want to get good journalism, if you want to get stories that are inconvenient to the powerful, you have to look at the web, I think.